What matters is that I put on the record, in one way or another, the opposition to euthanasia and the encouragement of hope, so that when people look at this issue, there isn't just one voice and there isn't complete resignation over the state of affairs.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of
faith,
culture,
and reason.
I'm your host, Todd Fung, and today I'm honored to be joined by one of the most vibrant and life-filled young women that I've ever met, who spends a lot of her time, ironically, talking about death. Amanda Ekman, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, did I get your last name correct? Ekman?
Yes.
All right, good, good. For those of you that don't know, Amanda is the founder of an organization called Dying to Meet You, which seeks to humanize our conversations and experiences around suffering, death, meaning, and hope. She does interviews and short films, community events, conversations, speaking tours. I met her in New Zealand when she came here. She's from Canada, by the way. The Catholic News Agency called Amanda the millennial with a mission, and I kind of agree with that. That's a good one. Amanda's been to Poland, where she studied and got her master's degree in philosophical studies. And upon returning to Canada, she served as a senior advisor to a member of parliament working to prevent the expansion of euthanasia. So, Amanda, before we get into any of the deep stuff, tell us quickly about your spiritual journey. When and how did you come to Christ?
Sure. Well, I was raised in a Christian household, although both of my parents have Jewish background. And so that's a whole separate story. But basically, with really a passionate Jewish identity combined with a lifelong practice of Christian faith. And so when we grow up in a family, we simply receive what's given and perhaps don't think it's so unusual. But as I've grown, I've seen, oh, that's actually a rather unusual upbringing to grow up celebrating Jewish and Christian holidays and with a great sensitivity to both traditions and both communities in a certain sense. And so that was definitely something that heightened my religious sensitivity from a young age. And that's part of the story.
Well, cool. Outside of kind of your ministry and stuff, what do you do to relax? What helps you relax? What do you enjoy? Do you have any hobbies, outdoors, indoors, whatever?
I'm from Calgary, Alberta, so the Rocky Mountains of Canada, and I really love hiking in the Rockies, and it's always very nostalgic when I go back. I'm living in a different part of the country right now, but I love hiking and I love traveling. I visited New Zealand, as you mentioned, and that was actually my 40th country.
And
very passionate about traveling and pilgrimaging and all the friends I meet along the way that enrich my life.
That's awesome. And you didn't get to actually do any hiking, backpacking in New Zealand, did you? You went to Hobbiton, but that was about it as far as the adventure goes.
Got to keep a reason to come back.
There we go. We'd love to have you back. So what led you, Amanda, to personally start Dying to Meet You, the organization? Was there a kind of a moment or an encounter that changed how you saw death and dignity?
I would say it's quite gradual, and it's neat to look back and trace the kind of providential thread in retrospect. I mentioned my Jewish Christian upbringing, and a big component of my motivation was having my Polish Jewish atheist grandfather live with my family throughout my high school and early university years. He had thankfully come to Canada before the Second World War. And because all of the extended family perished in the Holocaust, that had really shaken his faith and his understanding of God. And so he moved in with us after my grandmother passed away. He came to live with my parents and my younger brother. And yeah, I was finishing high school. I was beginning my university studies. And it was right around that time that he was in our home and I was having every family meal with him. And we would go on grandfather, granddaughter dates to Italian restaurants. And we were really close. In fact, I felt like he was the kind of family member I needed to understand myself, to understand my own identity, to introduce me to my roots and all of that kind of thing. So It was right while he was living with us that the government of Canada started talking about euthanasia for people whose deaths are reasonably foreseeable. And so this might not have caught my attention as a young person, if not for having my own grandfather, who at the time was quite elderly, he was in his late 80s and early 90s, living with us.
And how old were you at the time?
I was like late high school, early university, so like 18 to 20, around there. And yeah, so he was always present to me. And I think this is really crucial because I think of a Jewish philosopher named Immanuel Levinas, and he likes to talk about the human face. And he says that it's the relationship with the human face that is immediately ethical in nature. The face is what says to a person, the face of another is what beckons to a person the awareness of thou shalt not kill. And so it was really the face of my grandfather. And I can't say that I was constantly meditating on this or thinking at this level of reflection while we were just going about our family life together. But in retrospect, I can see that that daily encounter that I had around the dinner table or in conversation, leaving my term papers on his pillow, he would leave the Canadian Jewish news on my pillow, and we'd always have lots to talk about, that this really made me wake up to the risk of euthanasia to, first and foremost, the elderly, because that's where it began, with those who are terminally ill, those who are aging. And also because of my closeness with my grandfather, I saw those bouts of despair or those depressive episodes as he would suffer, as he would undergo certain things. And he had a supportive, loving family, but still, there were times of pain, weakness, also missing my grandmother, lots of different things. And that gave me a kind of sensitivity to the kinds of risks, especially to the elderly, to reject their own life, to not see the sense of living any longer. And especially because it was not only my grandfather, but a few other elderly people who really formed and forged me, I couldn't shake this feeling of precariousness that euthanasia started to elicit, even in my own heart. And so just to mention some of the other elderly people who I was close to, when I was 18, kind of at my grandfather's instigation, I decided to travel to Germany and Poland to study the Holocaust. And that was long before I decided to do my master's degree there. I simply traveled there with 60 students and two Holocaust survivors in 2010. And that trip, too, gave me a real ethical sensitivity and made me reflect on suffering and death. If ever there were people who deserved to opt out of life early, we could think maybe it would be people who were in concentration camps. But sure, that didn't happen as often as people might have expected. There was such a thirst for life. There was such a yearning to be reunited with loved ones. For many people, the memory of their loved ones and the hope that they would find them and reunite sustain them. And so I think just as an 18-year-old traveling with that level of intensity on a kind of pilgrimage of hope through death camps, it's hard to overstate what that did in my soul and on my life's journey. So to fast forward, my grandfather thankfully passed away naturally in 2015, and that was 1 year before Canada actually did legalize euthanasia. And when Canada first legalized it, it was with all of the supposed safeguards. Death had to be reasonably foreseeable, a grievous and irremediable condition. And as we know, it didn't stay there, because once legalized, euthanasia simply cannot remain limited. And this is why. Some people might say, why can't we just have a measured, regulated, tight, assisted dying, euthanasia, assisted suicide program? Well, the reason comes down to the fundamental outlook on life and death. If euthanasia, if prematurely ending a patient's life, is a reasonable and compassionate means of alleviating suffering, why wouldn't we allow it for more and more people? And if people are suffering physically and as they near death, well, there are certainly people who suffer even more who aren't at end of life. So it became seen as unfair to not allow those who suffer the same pain, if not worse, earlier in life, not to opt for it. And of course, we know that people suffer mental suffering, logical suffering, physical pain is not the only form of suffering in this life. Sometimes the mental anguish can be even worse. And so that's why fewer than 5 years after Canada had legalized euthanasia, the government started talking about expanding it on the basis of disability and mental illness, ostensibly on the grounds of equality. And it was around that time that I was by then working with a member of parliament, pro-life member of parliament in Canada, where I had the opportunity to mount resistance to this euthanasia expansion. And in large part, it was receiving the stories of hundreds upon hundreds of fellow citizens imploring us not to allow this expansion of euthanasia, that those stories are on my conscience forever. I realize the political issues of the day, people move on, but I couldn't move on. I couldn't shake them. Those stories from the height of the pandemic of people saying, if this had been in place when I was going through my depressive episode, I wouldn't be here today. Don't make it easier for us to die. We need the supports to live. By the way, how many Canadians don't have a family doctor? How long does it take to get proper psychiatric care? How long does it take to receive any of the basic social supports and benefits that give a person the will to live? So all of that was put on my conscience in a very powerful way. And step by step, realizing that the law was going to pass anyway, it was a foregone conclusion, we were outnumbered in parliament, that's when I started to think, what can I do? How can I, as a young person full of ideals, mount resistance to the fact that I don't even think we have only a culture of death, but we have death without culture. We're losing the rituals around death and dying and becoming a society that doesn't know how to accompany people through these eminently human experiences. So I wanted to recapture that. And in the course of desiring that, realized that the more I thought about suffering, death, meaning, and hope, the more I came alive and felt the kind of moral urgency that makes life worth living altogether.
Yeah. Didn't you in 2021, you blogged about death every single day of the year?
Yeah, exactly. So I made a New Year's resolution on January 1st. And so that was, it's all archived on dyingtomeetyou.ca. And my current project is at dyingtomeetyou.com. And yeah, that was basically my own catharsis to deal with this euthanasia expansion happening anyway. And realizing that lives would be lost, I thought, well, what can I do based on my study of history, based on my study of figures of resistance, because I'm quite literally obsessed with figures of resistance under Nazism and communism. That the more I think about their lives and trace their steps throughout Europe, the more I see that they oftentimes did very simple acts, concrete deeds that were quite basic, like printing pamphlets or giving a talk or organizing a book study of some classic work of literature and then discussing it in an arena of freedom that liberated people to take responsibility in their own context. So I saw that some of these actions are available to us, that some of the actions of the heroes who I most admire were things that I could integrate, writing, speaking, endeavoring to live in truth, and in small ways contribute to resisting this culture of death and building a culture of life.
Yeah, that's awesome. What so currently in Canada, where is the legislation? Can people that suffer mental illnesses or people that are, you know, in some way disabled, can they, you know, claim medically assisted death help there? What age does someone have to be? Where does it lie right now, Amanda?
Sure. I'll clarify it very precisely. The bill that passed into law on March 17th, 2021 was called Bill C-7. And that was the law that would expand euthanasia on the basis of disability initially. And then the Senate added mental illness, and that was passed together. However, there was a sunset clause, which would mean that immediately, as of that date that it passed, the disability piece would kick in, creating what we call Track 2 MAID, Medical Aid in Dying, Track 2 Euthanasia, for people with disabilities, neurological conditions, and chronic illnesses. And then
mentor anybody, like a 15-year-old.
Right now it's 18
and older.
Right now it's restricted to adults. And so initially it was disability. And yet the law passed to include those with mental illness as a sole underlying condition. However, the sunset clause meant that that piece, the mental illness as a sole condition, would not take effect for 2 years. So the first part was passed in 2021 with both pieces, but then this was all just to distract people, to basically minimize people's attention to the issue and hope that people would not keep following it. But in fact, the opposite happened, and other countries were sounding the alarm, and Canadian psychiatrists were sounding the alarm. And so they delayed it by one more year. So from 2023, and then said, okay, we're not ready yet. Let's wait till 2024. Mm-hmm. And then the government delayed it again to 2027. And so the language has been, we're not ready to expand euthanasia to people whose sole underlying condition is a mental illness like depression.
Yeah.
And yet we'll never be ready, because it will never be appropriate to give suicide assistance to some people while we claim and purport to give suicide prevention to others. So what we do have in Canada currently, and what we have had since 2021, is track one, the terminally ill track. And that does represent the majority of euthanasia cases. But increasingly, people are dying by euthanasia, by a direct lethal injection administered by a doctor or nurse within 15 minutes, who are also track two, the disability track, meaning that they are not imminently dying, that they would not die otherwise. And so that's what we have now. And yes, currently it is restricted to adults. And yet the recommendation that has come up from the euthanasia lobby group is that euthanasia be extended to so-called mature minors, which is the word used.
I mean, you talk about if ever there was a slippery slope, that's the one.
And what we also have is the French province of Quebec is breaking federal law and getting away with it by euthanizing people with dementia who are not able to consent at the moment of death. So it used to be a safeguard that you would be required to give contemporaneous consent. And if in the last moment you want to refuse, you're free to. But now what Quebec has ushered in about a year ago, October 30th of 2024, they started to allow euthanasia by advance request, meaning that as soon as a person is diagnosed with a capacity eroding condition, such as dementia, this would be the main one, then they can make an application to have an advance request to die by maid if they hit certain criteria. So it's very speculative. The person may be diagnosed with dementia at age 70 and become very fearful upon receiving this diagnosis, which is difficult for sure. But you don't know how you're going to live it. You don't know how it's going to go. And the person may say, when I no longer recognize my children or my spouse throughout a period of several weeks, then I want you to euthanize me. And so there's a clear lack of consent with these deaths. And even the federal Liberal Justice Minister said, this is currently in violation of Canadian federal law, but we're not going to prosecute Quebec for doing this. Instead, we're going to launch a national conversation on advance requests to survey the rest of the country to see if we should follow suit with this policy that I refer to as death for dementia, because euthanasia by advance request is tantamount to a policy of death for dementia. It is euthanasia without consent. And if we allow euthanasia without consent in this context, then why would there not also be an allowance of euthanasia without consent in other contexts?
Sure, sure. So what groups lobby the hardest for MAID, in your country?
The main groups are Dying with Dignity, a euthanasia lobby group that's been around for about 40 years. And they have as their stated mission the goal of relieving unwanted suffering. And since most suffering is unwanted, that has found a resonance with people, especially people who are fearful about losing their autonomy and losing control. The main reasons why people seek euthanasia are surveyed by our federal government. And the number one kind of suffering that leads people to request euthanasia is not actually related to physical pain or suffering. That's not even in the top three of the list. The main kinds of suffering that motivate people to request euthanasia are an inability to engage in meaningful life activities, an inability to perform the daily activities of personal care, and this fear of losing control, autonomy, a sense of dignity, fear of being a burden. And so euthanasia primarily represents an existential issue, not so much a medical issue, because with proper palliative care, pain can be managed. But what cannot be managed adequately in our current climate is that loss of meaning, is that sense of despair upon developing maybe later in life a disability with which you haven't had to cope before.
Yeah,
and so again, I'm so fascinated by the stories of figures in history who have displayed such resilience and fortitude, who would have had every reason to give up their life or to feel dejected about what they've lost, and yet who go on. I mean, this is a very anecdotal, but it just comes to my mind and heart right now. I was in Toronto a couple years ago, and I was meeting a family of Yazidi refugees. So the Yazidis are a minority who were heavily persecuted by ISIS terrorists. And I found out from this woman who was serving this wonderful Middle Eastern food, she told me that 25 of her family members had been killed by ISIS. And now this family is, they're refugees in Toronto. And I said, how do you go on? How do you live after you've lost 25 of your relatives? And she said, well, we just do. I mean, the answer was not complicated. It was, we just do. We have to. And life goes on. And then the other was, well, for all those ones who were lost, this is an attempt at wiping out our entire people. We have a responsibility to live, to be in the world, to educate our children, to pass on the language and the customs and traditions and that sense of responsibility. And I'm just very moved by that, because there's a real decadence to euthanasia. There's this sense of, once I can't live exactly as I please, then my life is of no use to me. That's so decadent. Our lives are not our own. Our lives are not only for enjoyment. And so you asked if I have hobbies. And of course, it's important to live a balanced life and to live a well-integrated life, something I can always strive for more. At the same time, life is not just for fun. I feel such a profound sense of responsibility. I love the quotation by Hannah Arendt, who said, education is the moment at which we decide whether we love the world enough to take responsibility for it. And this is precisely the way in which I love the world. I love it to the point of taking responsibility. I pass all these elderly people every day in the street. I listen to them in coffee shops. I just notice older people all the time. And also, as I look at them, I wonder about them. I wonder about how they're coping with aging, with their frailty, with their losses. I pray for them and I think about them. And being for them, living my life for their sake, even in a way that they are unaware of, is really interesting to me. Like, it's really a cause of my life that I, as a young person, feel so animated by, so enthused by. And I just want to let people know that our lives, we're capable of making a gift of ourselves no matter what. And it doesn't only depend on what we can do. Sometimes we are a gift to others without even knowing it and without intending to be. And because many people have been a gift to me in that way, I want to affirm people that your gift of self doesn't depend on what you produce, how you perform, what you achieve. It doesn't even depend on your piety or even on your family relationships. Even good things, it doesn't depend upon, because somehow God is working in and through us with every breath that we have in ways that are not wholly up to us, that are very mysterious. And I think we've lost touch with that, but that it's worth recapturing.
Yeah, but certainly you must get the pushback. Who are you, some young, healthy, vivacious, world-traveling, 30-something-year-old, to tell me, 80-something-year-old, in dire pain every day and can't move and get around, who are you to tell me that I'll just suck it up, basically? There's a lot to live for, as you frolic off to another part of the world. Certainly you get that, or some version of that.
Yeah, sure. I think the first is not to underestimate what I myself have suffered that leads
That's
me to
fair.
And there are a lot of hidden sources of my identification with those who suffer. And when I speak to the older audiences who at first have that skepticism of me, eventually I speak in such a way where something changes and they realize, oh, this is actually a bond of communion between us. And however we were dismissing you, we don't deserve to dismiss you anymore. And I just love those moments because I do think this is a real occasion for intergenerational solidarity. And I mean, there's also a self-interest. I would not want to grow old in the society we have currently. It's not a place in which getting dementia, having a disability, like these things are becoming fearful because of our social climate, but it need not be. There are other parts of the world where becoming elderly or even becoming disabled isn't the end of the world in the same way that we're making it out to be because of social conditions.
Sure.
There's a disability author who I was reading recently, and she said, like, disabled people have like lots of problems, and like our disability isn't it. The problems are in the social treatment and the lack of access and in the way that we're looked at and things like that. So there's that. There's also a lot to be said about how this issue is not restricted to any age demographic. While we might think it's predominantly affecting older people who are close to death, who do suffer all kinds of physical pain, partly I would say older people deserve better. People with disabilities deserve better. People with mental health crises deserve better than death. We must insist that people deserve better than death. And as a young person full of ideals, I want to spend my life and my energy and my health creating the conditions where we can live well until we die, where there's no point at which you become discarded, dismissed, and discounted because of what you can no longer do. I think that's relevant to younger generations. I think in the more and more I listen to people's temptation for euthanasia, the more and more I think there's a lot in common with what I heard as a teenager and young adult around self-harm and self-esteem. Like, these issues of euthanasia represent a crisis of self-harm and a crisis of self-esteem. And we treat young people one way with respect to these topics, and we are treating older people a different way.
That's fair.
And I think everybody deserves suicide prevention. Everybody deserves self-harm prevention. Everybody deserves to be addressed when their self-esteem is low and met with a look of love that helps them, because the request for euthanasia betrays that underlying underlying insecurity. Like, am I really lovable anymore?
Yeah.
And I see the self-protection inherent in it, and I empathize with it profoundly, where the guard goes up and you'd rather prevent your disappointment of not being loved and cared for by saying, that's it, I'll just go out on my own terms. And that's where there's so much in common with self-harm, because it's an endeavor to control an out-of-control or uncontrollable situation of end of life and suffering and illness, where what is that last shred of control that a person may wield? Selecting the date of their death. And it is this sham form of empowerment that you gather everyone around and summon them, not to keep vigil for you as you are dying, which is what we're meant to do, but by imposing the vigil and guaranteeing it, but in this sham way where it's not a vigil at all, because you've reduced your death to a 15-minute appointment that can be conveniently scheduled into place and not disrupt anyone's lives. I want to embolden people that they actually fulfill rather than disrupt the lives of others, not only of those who profoundly love them, but of anyone who's engaged in their life to serve them. You are the fulfillment, not the disruption, of others' work, of others' attention, of others' affection. This is so deep. This is so much connected to our deepest identity. And I think it's so much related to the feeling of precariousness. We have all these books about young people being an anxious generation. I mean, which generation isn't on smartphones right now, but particularly young, an anxious generation. What is more anxiety inducing than losing your grandparents to euthanasia and then risking, what is more anxiety inducing than losing, I would say, your grandparents to euthanasia and then fearing that your parents will be next?
Yeah.
And then thinking that you might be doomed and die this way.
To the same fate, yeah.
It's does it contagion element to it, honestly.
Does it, it's scary to think that the right to die can become the duty to die, you know? Unfunded liabilities and stuff, and there's, you know, we're running out of money for, you know, social programs and whatnot. And so it's up to me to do the right thing. I've lived my life. I've got to get out of the way and stop being a drain on the resources of Canada or whatever nation I'm in. And does that come into your thinking at all?
There is a way in which those considerations come up both at the micro and family level and then also at the macro and state level. Mm. So I'd say at the level of federal governments, to be candid about the Canadian government, there was actually the publication of a cost savings estimate of euthanasia, where a parliamentary budget officer crunched the numbers of projected savings through euthanasia deaths. Now, that represents the sincerely sinister economic calculation in euthanasia. And at the familial level, I have heard even when I went to a Dying with Dignity event when I was quite young, I showed up before euthanasia had even been legal. And I like to say that I drank their coffee, but not their Kool-Aid at these meetings. And I met this woman who said, well, I think my children would like my money. And so I should get to decide when I go so that I can give them more of an inheritance rather than wasting away in some retirement home. And so there's this perverse, distorted sense of making a gift of oneself through either leaving money or also leaving organs, because Canada is also leading in organ donation, if it could be called that, after euthanasia. And so we see all of these distorted incentives when really we are short-circuiting opportunities to love. We are eroding the tenderness of our society by ejecting people from the community of human belonging prematurely. We are not learning how to cope with in the face of suffering, but we're just getting example after example of avoidism of suffering. And how can people be resilient and courageous if euthanasia becomes as widespread as it has become? Now in Canada, 1 in 20 deaths is euthanasia. 1 in 20 is a doctor or nurse directly causing the death of a patient in a hospital, home, or even in
You lead the world in that, don't you, unfortunately?
Yeah, and so we've got something peculiar going on in our society that deserves attention, because 10 years ago, this was unthinkable. And now it's so normalized and even romanticized to the point that you almost have to justify why you wouldn't die by euthanasia. And the thing is, anyone who supports euthanasia or is contemplating it thinks that they or the case they have in mind is so exceptional. So exceptional. The extenuating circumstance. Oh, but I know someone who. Oh, but if this were the case.
Right.
I hate to break it to people, but all of these extenuating circumstances are not special. They are what is leading to the 5% euthanasia death rate in our country. What people think is so unique and extraordinary is the compounding statistic that makes Canada the euthanasia capital of the entire world. And I don't think anybody is really thinking about how because when you suffer, you are closed in on yourself. When we suffer, we can't see a horizon of transcendence. It's hard to get out of ourselves. It's hard to be concerned about others. It's hard to imagine a future. It's hard. we need someone else. We need someone
right.
else.
Right.
And so I do not fault people for experiencing suicidal ideation. I think that's very normal in the course of a human life to experience depression, despair,
yeah.
and even the temptation to suicide. These are all
yeah.
experiences that we undergo. And this is why projects around mental health and projects around suicide prevention are so crucial and so generally well supported by the population. And so it doesn't shock me, and it need not shock us, that all of these realities exist. But what we must insist on is that we don't concede and capitulate to a person in their moment of despair, that you don't like give someone a push, you give someone a hand.
Yeah.
And I desperately want to create culture where these realities of suffering, illnesses, and disabilities don't make you so fearful. Because I honestly am more afraid of fitting the eligibility criteria for MAID than I am of any diagnosis, even a terminal diagnosis.
Wow.
I don't want to be told I qualify for a doctor to end my life. There are stories of people going in. There was a woman who went in for a mastectomy, and before this life-saving surgery, was asked if she had considered MAID. How do you entrust yourself? How do you put yourself
wow.
into the hands of physicians in this degree of vulnerability, with all your hopes for survival and for your life to flourish after this intervention, with that seed planted?
Wow.
And how do you have that be one of the last thoughts before you're put under for surgery, planted? Wow. It's so disruptive. You could
sure.
hardly fault someone for running the other way out of the hospital upon hearing this. And yet euthanasia is raised unsolicited countless times to people, countless times, because once again, euthanasia is seen as a healthcare option or a reasonable means of treatment,
yeah.
then doctors are not afraid of raising it. They're afraid of the repercussions from the colleges of physicians and surgeons for not raising it. They're afraid of the penalties and reprimand
right.
if they don't present euthanasia. But simply having euthanasia suggested, in my opinion, already kills the person. It defeats and deflates a person's sense of worth and value. That is so tragic. Nobody deserves to be told that they could just as well be dead. This is psychologically super disruptive, super an affront to human dignity, and I simply cannot do anything else in my life while this call and cause has been put on my heart. It's so precise. It's so clear that if not me, who?
And you were born for such a time as this. You should have been Esther.
What is life for if not attending to some of these things? And with a real moral urgency, sometimes people say to me, oh, well, don't worry about the... And this is hard for me to hear, but oh, don't worry about this generation, the boomer generation, because they're a lost cause. They're all going to go get euthanized. Just focus on young people. There's a lot more hope with young people embracing the faith and seeing
Morbid.
Clearly. And that is a euthanasia mindset. That is a euthanasia mentality. Whenever we would write off a generation, for me, my preferential option is to the generation that is most at risk and most susceptible to euthanasia, which are the elderly citizens to whom I speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a current and imminent crisis. I hear about...
Do you speak to young people, high school, college, you know, that kind of thing?
Sometimes I do. Yeah, sometimes I do. And I do like to promote intergenerational solidarity. And yet when I travel places, I basically have to negotiate and say, I'll speak to the high school or the university group for every retirement home I can get into, or for every audience of seniors who I can speak to. And some people think, well, you're young. You probably want to talk to young people. And part of the surprise of my mission is, no, I came for the older people.
Oh.
I came for you. And I see
how
this
beautiful.
In people's eyes. I see that in the eyes of the older people to whom I speak.
Mm-hmm.
Something happens when I expressed to them with directness and sincerity, I came here today for you. You're worth it. You're worth my time, my energy. You're worth all my investment in this issue because I came for you and for your life and to defend you. And I see the way in which their eyes kind of sparkle with this moment of, wow, like, this hasn't happened before.
Yeah. I've been thinking this whole time, Amanda, is that you know, you lobby Parliament and whatnot, and certainly you must get this. What is your prescription for hopelessness and despair? There's only one of you. It'd be nice if there were 10,000 of you to visit every convalescent home in Canada and give love and care and compassion and attention. You know, we can't put 500 milligrams of you into a pill and dispense it, you know, everywhere. So what's your prescription? Just changing, like you say, the culture of the nation and making more of you, multiplying yourself, the care ethic, the love and whatnot? Obviously, Christ is the ultimate answer, but you live in a secular society.
One of the things I seek to do is to bring people from the periphery and give them a platform. People who are the most affected and the least represented in our public discourse around euthanasia. So that's what I do through the short films I create. One of the first short films I made features a woman who at the time of the recording was 88 years old. She doesn't have a computer or an email address and she can't really see. And we became friends because everyone said, you have to go meet Christine. She, in her 80s, decided to get a tattoo right on her arm that says, don't euthanize me. So I met her. I visited her. We had some incredible time together. And then she agreed to be in one of these short films, which is called Don't Euthanize Me. And share the link to that. And then started to help tell the stories of children and grandchildren, the adult children and the adult grandchildren who have lost their loved ones to euthanasia, who are beginning to speak out about the toll that it has on them, only to be met often with accusations of selfishness, that they would love their loved ones so much as to oppose their premature death, and calls that they should just grow up and get over it. So this is partly why we don't have more family members speaking out than do, because it's very tragic in the first place to have that loss, and then even more difficult and painful to be met with that degree of misunderstanding. I've also interviewed people in hospital, people with chronic pain. And when I speak to different audiences and when I travel, I usually show one of these vignettes, which is about 4 to 5 minutes long, as part of my talk. Because if they can't be there physically with me, I want to amplify the voices of those I've spoken to and give others a means of encountering them. So that's one way. The other thing is back to the figures of resistance and ethical exemplars throughout history. What counts is that there's someone who says, no, I will not go along and I will not stand by idly as this happens. So I think there's great power. Even if my words don't find a massive audience or a huge platform, that should not surprise me, because to be a figure of resistance is to be understated and neglected. This is the prophetic dimension of witness. And so standing in the continuity with that tradition is my security and does prevent me from being particularly jostled by whatever response or reaction I might get. What matters is that I put on the record, in one way or another, the opposition to euthanasia and the encouragement of hope, so that when people look at this issue, there isn't just one voice and there isn't complete resignation over the state of affairs, but people have to reckon with this. I'll tell you a story that's very pertinent to this. I was up in the north of Canada. It was really exciting for me because I love getting to explore my country. In fact, my time outside of my country made me more and more patriotic and kind of yearn to be in every part of the country. So I went to the north. I went to the Yukon and spent some time up there speaking. I gave several talks, mostly to seniors. And it's a very small town, the capital up there of Whitehorse. And after a few days, I was in a coffee shop, and this woman who recognized me from my talk at one of the venues came into the coffee shop to speak with me. And she looked a little bit upset, so I braced myself. She said, "Amanda, I'm thinking about the talk you gave to us a few nights ago, and you said some interesting things that I'm continuing to ponder. But the reason I came in here to talk to you is because what I can't shake above all is just that you're dedicating your life to this." And that's a memory I cherish very much, because it goes to show that it isn't always what I say. As much as I try to communicate winsomely and as much as I try and learn the ins and outs of this issue through my intense engagement with it, sometimes what it really comes down to is witness. The fact that I come to these seniors and say that I am for them, the fact that I come alongside someone and bring a whole film crew to tell their story, even if it's primarily for their own catharsis, for their own personal benefit before it ever reaches YouTube or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so I take great consolation, because there's a beautiful quotation I like very much that says, "These crises of the world are crises of saints. We just need people to live with ardor and moral audacity in order to be the sign of contradiction against all these conventions of our society. That will be sufficient. I trust it will, because that is the light that dispels the darkness. Just one little flame dispels a lot of darkness." And another quotation that I've been pondering very much lately is, I'm so moved by it. I love to turn it over and over in my heart. And that is that dying is the way that a candle gives light. Dying is the way that a candle gives light. And so we have to give ourselves at the expense of our own substance. This is the gift of self that is costly. It may cost our health, our wealth, our relationships. Eventually it will cost our very life. But when we trust that we are burnt up in an offering for God, for others, that our lives are not our own, we realize that that is a basis for our liberation from all the attachments to things that are not lasting. And I love to ponder eternity and to think about the shortness of this life. Sometimes people ask me, "Well, how do you do this stuff and what led you to it?" And then sometimes I sincerely say, it was thinking about my own death. It's thinking sometimes when I lack courage or audacity, it's remembering the shortness of this life and that I will die. And then thinking, so what? Like, now what? What am I afraid of speaking? What am I afraid of writing? What am I afraid of putting out in the public square? If life is so short, and every day is given to us for our conversion to the deeper and deeper knowledge of the truth.
Yeah. Do you, I mean, I like that you're not, although you're obviously Christian and, you know, believe in God and whatnot, but you're not Bible bashing. You haven't said, you know, you are not your own. You're bought with a price. Glorify God in your body. And, you know, you don't have the right to do it. But nonetheless, do you get a pushback from culture, from people saying, "Well, you know, this, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in any of that. I'm not buying into your hype. Why should you legislate? I mean, if you and your, you know, Christian Catholic counterparts don't want to euthanize yourself, fine. But why take my, you know, right away?" I mean, how do you respond to that, which I'm sure you've got in your travels?
Those objections certainly come up. And I think one of the benefits is I work with so many people of different faiths and no faith on this topic. Some of the short films I've produced feature people who discuss their lack of any religious or, in some cases, political commitment. And they will insist that you don't need to be religious to oppose taking someone's life. And I am very heartened by how much common ground can be built with people from disparate political stripes and from all walks of life, because it's such an existential and human issue. So that's one thing, is that, like, I think it's unifying. I think it's not explicitly religious. For those who would say that, what right do you have to intercept this tantamount to a right that I want for how I die? I would just emphasize that, as a dear friend of mine says in one of the short films I produced, laws are for everyone. And there's a social cost to having euthanasia for the white, worried, and wealthy, as we sometimes put it, because that's the majority of people who are opting for it.
Yeah.
The trickle down
leads to an unequal access to palliative care, doesn't it? I mean, not everybody has the access to the palliative care that the white, wealthy, and what was the other one? White,
worried,
and wealthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a social cost. And I think sometimes with a little exercise in our moral and ethical imagination, we can see it. I don't know what the statistic is, but suppose that 9 out of 10 people with ALS opted for euthanasia.
Mm-hmm.
The ALS is a reason why many, many people choose it. And so if that were the case, if 8 or 9 out of 10 with ALS choose MAID, then how free is that other 1 or 2 not to choose it? Once it becomes so normalized,
right,
and people already have this feeling that they're being alleged of being selfish for living, that they're taking up resources, that they should give someone else a chance, there's a social pressure. And you simply cannot have criteria without it having a social cost. The fact of having criteria means that everyone who fits the criteria has a new valuation on their life. The fact of having any legal criteria for euthanasia implies that anyone and everyone who fits that criteria is viewed a certain way societally and legally. That's highly relevant. And so I would encourage people to think about that this really changes how we look at people. And to that, I would say we can do a lot as Christians in engaging in these topics more existentially, because what a person needs when they're tempted to euthanasia is probably love. Is probably
sure.
someone who says, I love you too much to see you go through with this. We need to, as one writer puts it so movingly, we need to be willing to risk our own faith by identifying with the one who suffers in their questioning of God. Otherwise, we are like Job's false friends, not really standing guard for our friends. We have to risk our own faith by entering in to that questioning of God on the part of the one who suffers, because one day that will also be us. And we will want
sure.
friends who don't meet us with platitudes or slogans about everything happening for a reason or about God having a plan. Those things can be true, but they can also be not the right thing to say.
Sure.
And I think often in meditating on scenes in the Gospels, that so often what Jesus gives to a person is a look, a touch, or a word that represents a before and after for their life. Sometimes, and oftentimes, it was a one-off. It wasn't even an ongoing relationship that he had with a person. It was an encounter. And so I think we can also take heart that there are some people who we will see very briefly, some people who we can touch only momentarily. But following Christ's example, that encounter can mark a before and after in that other person's life because of how they are met, because of the gaze with which we look at them, with eyes that are not just our own, but with a look with the eyes of love that God has for that person in our midst. And so we have to exercise our faith in ways that do justice to the novelty of every person before us. Every person and every suffering presents a unique situation to us. And so as prepared and as formed as we can be, we can never have it all ready to go in a scripted, preemptive way. And that's another thing that touches me in this work, is that I might face that temptation. If I could just find the things to say all the time, or if I could just be so persuasive with a smackdown argument.
Well, that does away with my final question, you know. What would you tell somebody with an aged old person that's contemplating that?
One thing I would say is, in the relationship that you have with that person, to find a way that is unique in particular to mount resistance. Because mounting resistance to what is basically suicidal ideation is always an act of love. And even if the person, in their freedom, harms themselves or ends their life, you cannot fail if you love them to the end. If the last thought that a person has in their mind is, I'm going through with this, but this person really didn't want me to do it because of love. Ugh. Okay, like, that's okay. And that's what we're called to love people to the end and to risk ourselves, risk our very selves by not speaking in abstractions, not talking about universal human dignity when someone is on the brink, but saying, I've got you. What do I need? What do I know? What do I need to know about you to best take care of you? What would need to be different in your situation for you to want to live? If your situation were different, would your answer here be different? And to be sufficiently invested, to be willing to co-suffer with the one who suffers. Again, it's not clear what that will look like in every instance. It takes a lot of discernment and patience and accompaniment. And also, the degrees of our relationships are different. And yet I don't hesitate anymore to say, even to strangers who write in comment threads beneath my videos, oh, I want to die by MAID. I don't hesitate anymore to say, I hope you don't. Because maybe I will be the only one who says, I hope you don't. If everyone in this quasi sham affirmation agrees with a person's so-called wishes, which I don't even believe they are a person's wish, I think that the request for euthanasia is not so much the expression of a desire to die as it is the expression of disappointment. Scratch the surface of any request for euthanasia and you will find a soul that is wounded and sorely disappointed. And so let us be confident that we can come alongside and find that disappointment, show tenderness, insistent, affectionate pressure will be a force of love, and we just cannot lose when we do all of these things.
Yeah.
Even if
I could go another hour with you, but I know you cannot. You have another engagement. But I want to just thank you for being on the show. You've been delightful. You've been an inspiration, and just a role model of how we should handle this and people and live our lives. And so if you want to hear Amanda Moore, well, go to her YouTube channel. Is it Dying to Meet You?
And then YouTube, and then dyingtomeetyou.com has all the videos. So yeah. Check out dyingtomeetyou.com, and all the videos are on social media. You can reach out to me if you have a story, if you want to share, if something spoke to you in this, feel free to write to me. I love getting emails and this is what I love to do. So
yeah. And your last name, Amanda, A-C-H-T-M-A-N, A-C-H-T-M-A-N. Thank you so much for being on the show. And we hope that you'll subscribe to the Thinking Matters podcast, where you'll hear more interesting guests like Amanda. So hope to see you next time. God bless.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.